posse, and we'll get away.
I'm Brian Law with the City Transit Division, and I have I can go a little bit into the presentation. It should be in your packet, so I don't plan to read through every slide. I hope you've had a chance to read through them. But if you have questions about those, please don't hesitate to ask. I want to start, though, by saying that what we're doing with this and bringing this before this committee and then later in front of the council is to ask for a continuation of the study that has already been undertaken. In other words, we did a study of cooperative busing with the school district. It uncovered some more questions that we really wanted to get at, and so now we're wanting to do a phase two, kind of an implementation of that. So this is not, strictly speaking, this is not a question about school start times or whether to enter into an agreement with the public schools. This is really just, can we go ahead and do further study on this to get more answers to questions that have come up. So as you can see here, we've done a study that involves six of the public schools, all three high schools and three of the middle schools. We see that there are some students that could be served by existing RPT routes, but new routes to do the scheme as we came up with would require 16 new routes. Three trips a day, morning, after school, and then after school activities. And we would hopefully serve about 60% of students eligible for busing. This would require a lot more buses than we currently have. It would require 50 buses at the peak period. We could use 28 of our existing fleet, but it would require 22 more. There are costs, obviously, with this, and we estimate, based on our study so far, that it would be anywhere from $839,000 to $934,000 in increased operating costs for Rochester Public Transit across 5 years. There would be a lot of capital, though. Like I said, if we're talking about 22 new buses, figuring about $475,000 apiece for a 40-foot bus. Also, we need a place to store them. They need to be somewhere overnight, so that means a bigger garage than what we currently have and what we're currently expanding.
We got a question, Mr. Higgins. Yeah.
How many years do we capitalize a bus over?
15 minimum, and we may be able to get a little bit more out of them.
Okay, did we have an estimate for the capital storage expansion cost?
That's part of what this phase two would get into. This is a look at the fleet. The blue bars are what we have planned for the future in the next 5 years based on the transit development plan. And the orange bars with 22 buses on top of that, that would be the 22 I'm talking about if cooperative busing were made possible with the school district. So these two charts are really the key of what we're looking at. This is really kind of what we learned in the first phase of the study. So the chart on the left shows they both show operating costs. The chart on the left shows a gray line at the bottom that shows the RPS estimates for operating costs for the next 5 years if no changes are made. And likewise, the blue line above that shows the Rochester Public Transit estimated operating costs if none of these changes are made. The yellow line shows what RPS might save with this collaboration. And that comes out to a little over $1 million a year. The orange line shows the increase in costs that RPT would have to absorb, and as I mentioned earlier, that could be somewhere in the neighborhood of $800,000, $900,000 a year. So those gaps really are what we want to get a better understanding of. Those are really a big part of the question here. The chart on the right shows the same kind of cost, but we're stacking them, so totaling both systems together. So the blue bars show RPT and RPS total without any collaboration. And the orange lines show, or the orange bars show, again, what they would be with the collaboration. So the gap still seems to be there, and so we want to get a better idea of is that something that's worthwhile to do? What are some of the other costs that might be associated with that? And also getting further into the capital costs too. That's going to be a big part of the question. So the phase two scope is summarized here on these next two slides. The study would be funded 50-50 between public transit and the school system as the first phase was. We would have to look at how Federal Transit Administration non-compete rules apply. This whole scenario assumes a start time of public school, of the middle and high schools at 8:45 a.m. So again, that's not really part of the question of this study. We want to look at phasing. Can this be done gradually? We would obviously produce route maps and timetables. There would have to be some kind of plan as to how students would get on board and pay their fare. And we would come up with a preferred means for RPS to reimburse or fund the public transit system. We have here a 2019 and 2020 school year start. As soon as that may be sliding in the future. I think that getting anything started by 2019 at this point would be very ambitious and very aggressive. Again, looking more at the operating costs, getting those into greater detail, looking at the capital costs in much greater detail, seeing what the school district savings and return on investment would be, and the funding sources and funding impacts that this would have, both in terms of the public transit system getting the funds it needs to take on this added service, but also what would be the impact on the school district's funding as well. So basically, phase one of the study that we have done so far, and that was the draft that was included in your packets, we were entering that phase of the study to see, is there anything that logistically, you know, physically, practically, would prevent this from going forward? We really didn't necessarily find that. In fact, we saw a lot of promise with this idea. It's costly, but we did find that it's probably possible, it could be done. So if costs are since costs are a big part of it, that's why we wanted to get into the phase two, see what those really are, get a much better understanding of what those are, so that we could present to the school board and to the council a recommendation one way or the other on this. And hopefully then, with phase one and phase two of the study completed, both bodies would be in a much better position to make a knowledgeable decision about this question. So, with that...
Maybe Brian talk about the cost, the shared cost.
Yes, the study would be, the cost would be split 50-50.
And our portion would be?
About $27,000.
Any other questions for Brian? Mayor?
Is there a way, or maybe you've already done it, to measure not either the cost or the savings, but what the benefit is to the student?
Mm-hmm. Well, so like qualitative?
Yeah.
Well, there probably are some. And I think what we've, on the transit side, what we've always looked at is that this has the potential of making transit ridership something that's, basically you're training the next generation of transit riders. And you demystify the experience of getting on a city bus, and you make that less intimidating to younger people by making that part of their daily life. And in a city where transit is getting to be a bigger focus of public policy, I think that's going to be an important thing going forward. I'm not sure exactly how to measure that. Maybe surveys, probably, things like that.
Mr. Wojcik.
In order to execute on the potential 2019 time frame, how quickly are you able to get phase two results back to us? Is there enough of phase two to make that decision?
Well, the phase two probably, if we were able to get it underway fairly soon, I think we could probably have something in 3 or 4 months. That's about how long the first phase took. Okay. So at that point, we're basically then limited by the number of vehicles we would have, and there is that lead time to order vehicles of about 15 months or so. So,
Mr. Canton?
So I'm gonna plain speak it down to my level. We're taking the bus route from the school district away, complementing it for slight enhancement to city route that's already generally in the vicinity to accommodate students. The net is reduced cost for the school district, less than what we increase our costs for the buses. Okay, so I have a few questions, and they came to me in an email from the city of Duluth. So Duluth, my understanding was, went through this process and decided to unwind it. Could you maybe describe what happened there? And
my understanding of Duluth is that they did try something quite different than this. They were basically contracting for, they basically were taking over the yellow school bus routes in their city. Okay. So what we're proposing here, these would be general public routes. What they did in Duluth was different. They basically were running student-only buses and student-only routes. And you're right, they didn't like that experience. But what we're proposing, or what we're studying here, is what we're assuming for the purposes of the study is something different. It would be just like any other transit routes, and it would be the general public could ride them. And the plan would be how to get more students to ride them and how they would pay and things like that.
So you're speaking my language when we're talking about saving money. So I like that idea. I've got a few concerns with, I thought some of the points that got delivered to me by someone with experience on the Duluth system still sound like they're applicable. They basically said, when you contract to do student drop-off, it's different than adult drop-off. Things like students getting off the bus and maybe not making the best decision about which way to cross a road, what's the system's liability in terms of when that student gets off the bus, bullying and other things that take place on the bus and having to have drivers intervene in that. I'm kind of concerned generally about maybe those more, you know, it's easy to run the numbers, I think, on the hard details of this is the bus and this is the cost and here's how we depreciate it. That's what shows up. What I don't think shows up, and maybe my larger concern about this is maybe more the soft details of how this would work. You know, with our existing bus staff, are they trained to do those interventions? What is the difference? What's our liability in those regards? Can we speak to that, or is that what you're telling me I have to pay another $27,000
to get? Well, some of that's already taken care of in the first phase of the study. And so, for example, that kind of in loco parentis kind of stuff is not really going to be a concern for us. We are talking about general service, general public routes here. So the... you know, once the passenger gets off of our bus, they're, you know, they can ask the driver which way to go, but it's not the driver's responsibility to guide them in any particular direction. We're assuming here there would be an experience like putting students who currently ride our buses,
right.
Same exact kind of thing. So they could be trespassed off the bus if they were causing trouble. They would pay a fare. Somehow they would pay a fare to get on board. And, you know, the drivers would intervene in any kind of altercations or anything like they would with between any passengers. And other systems have looked into that sort of, these are fears that come up, you know, whenever you're talking about transporting a lot of school-aged children unsupervised. And most other systems that have looked into this haven't really found those fears to materialize. And they're in much bigger systems than ours. As for liability and things like that, again, it would be an expansion of what we currently do, and it would be covered under our current operating.
Yeah, so it's not so much modifying the delivery of the service to accommodate them. We might change routes. Mm-hmm. The bus service you have today is the bus service you'll have tomorrow, just with potentially more students involved.
Okay. Riding 16 new routes that operate like our current routes do.
So, Brian, when we originally talked about this, we talked about, you're talking about adding 16 routes. We were talking about less congestion on the roads. Did you see that? How many school buses would be removed by doing this?
In the study so far, I haven't seen a count of the numbers of school buses, but that information, I'm sure, is available. The school district could tell us. Maybe not right this minute, but that's going to be... That would be part of it, because part of this idea is also that the yellow bus program is not going to just go away. It's going to be redistributed out into areas of the district that are outside the city, and to better serve those areas as well.
Mr. Hayden.
So we're talking about adding for the city, adding 22 buses at a capital cost of $10 million. I didn't put a number on the expanding the bus garage, but say it's another $10 million. Now we're talking $1 million a year operationally. So the presentation kind of talked about how we can maybe mitigate some of these additional expenses. But back to the question, why would the city be motivated to take on a mission currently served by a different unit of government? So I understand the school district may want this, you know, for whatever reason. But why would the city want to do this? Why would the city want to take on the mission of another unit of government that already is served?
Well, first of all, we don't know the city wants to. That's part of what we want to get at with the study, is to get us better information as to...
I thought the study was going to determine cost. So the study is going to determine whether this is a good idea?
Yes. I mean, cost will be a big part of making that recommendation. But
so why would you even commission a study if there was no... if there's no compelling reason for the city to take on this mission?
Well, there could be benefits that come from it. Increased ridership would be one. And like I said before, there are the options to train a new generation of bus riders and get them regularly riding trains.
So the benefit to the city is we want to indoctrinate middle school and high school students to be bus riders? Or, I mean, I'm just trying to understand what we're doing.
Well, no, I'd say that it would help to, first of all, deliver them to school on time.
So the yellow school buses aren't getting there on time now?
I'm sure they are.
All right. Thanks.
Mr. Bojack.
Boy, it's hard to follow up indoctrinate, but I'll do my best. Let's talk about what the benefits would be, because you know what? These kids that this program serves, they're our constituents too. And how they do in our community is important to us. It should be important to us. But let's run down what some of the potential benefits would be. And ultimately, there's going to be an economic decision. There's, like anything, there's cost-benefit. And, you know, what is the local cost of tax dollars? And remember, we're increasing our local route by, what, about 80% in 5 years, and with a de minimis increase in local tax dollars going into that. So this might be another enhancement. But in terms of possible benefits, and one thing before I jump into them, I wanted to ask you, is this still assuming like a three turns of the crank? Where you've got a before school, after school, and an evening activity run. So there's a lot of benefits to be had here. First and foremost, let's talk about getting 16 new routes enhancing our transit system at peak times. Very nice. The issue came up with concerns about the interaction between kids and adults. No different than adults. The school has policies on how they deal with this on their own buses. Very similar here. And I am entirely confident that... kids in the presence of adults will act better, and adults in the presence of kids will also act better. I believe that I don't think the community wants us to have our silos. I think they want us to be working together on this, and I think they understand that merging these transit systems is, in the long run, going to be far more efficient for us. Let's not underestimate the importance of that later start time. We've got a delegation here from the school district. And there's mountains of literature saying that we are just starting our middle school and high school kids too early, and it is detrimental to their educational performance. And this is something that they fully understand is a great way of making life a little bit easier on our middle school and high school students. And they, the school board, have come to this conclusion on their own based on a mountain of data. And this is something we as a community can do better for our kids. Let's talk about the opportunity to better provide services and opportunities to disadvantaged students. It might not be a big deal for our kids to get to and from practice, but you know what? For a lot of other kids, it is. They don't necessarily have the same transportation mobility that we have. They don't have that same level of privilege. So what we can do is, by having this additional turn of the crank, kids can, in the after-school hours, they can go from their school activities to whatever might be available in the community, and that includes our art center, our civic theater, Quarry Hill, library, any number of other options that are good options out there for kids, as opposed to what they might not have, particularly those in areas that are underserved by transit currently. And then they have a safe way of getting home at night. The school district, they talk a lot about the achievement gap, and there's a relationship between the achievement gap and these opportunities that kids have. This is something, these are our constituents, these are our people, that we have an opportunity to improve the health, safety, and welfare of, that we can do this. And let's not underestimate that training the next generation of transit riders. That is something that's important. There's sometimes a disconnect when you're in a mid-sized city like this going to transit. People who have lived in cities, Rochester, smaller their entire life, don't always have that familiarity of going in there and getting on the bus. There's an additional advantage that we have some of our own technology things that we have to figure out. And if there's a way of doing this with a key fob or something where the kids are getting on the bus and using their fob to effectively pay or document they're getting on the bus so the information is recorded and the payment takes place, that is technology that benefits us all as well. So I would argue that there are tremendous benefits, and I would caution us that using language like indoctrinating is divisive at best. And furthermore, the benefits here, even if they're benefits that help our school district, for God's sakes, these kids are still part of our community. So we should weigh their welfare in this as well.
Any other questions for Brian? Before we leave this subject, we do have Mr. Munoz in the audience from the school system. And since you're here, Mr. Munoz, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, first of all, I thank you for allowing me to have an opportunity here. We're entering, hopefully, into this partnership not to save money. That's not our intent. We're not trying to cut our cost. We're trying to find a way to go to a one-tiered busing system. Mike mentioned there's tons of research out that right now the start time that we have for our secondary kids is not beneficial for them. We tried to go to a, when we put an RFP out for our last transportation contract, we tried to go to a one-tiered system. Nobody bid on it. They don't have enough buses or drivers to do that. So this is another way, we believe, to get to a one-tiered system. So I want to make perfectly clear, we're not doing this to try to save money. We're doing this to try to get to a one-tiered system. Now, just like you and just like my board, when the dollars come out, we'll have to figure out if it makes financial sense to do that. So I'm not going to say that's not a factor, but that's not our intent of wanting to do this. The other thing, I can't speak for Duluth. I can speak from Des Moines Public Schools. We did this when I was in Des Moines. We turned out that it was a win-win for our district and a win-win for the city. My understanding, I've been here almost 7 years. I don't know how many years you've been hearing from our community saying we need more routes in our community. This is an opportunity for you to get that and us help you do that, help share some of that cost by putting our kids on those buses. And you're right, it is good. It's training a new generation of kids. My child, my son lives in Chicago. That's how he gets around. He gets on a bus. That's when we visit, we get on a bus with him. We have to train our kids. You know, we're talking about all the traffic downtown. What's better to train our young adults, and hopefully most of them will stay in Rochester when they become adults, train them how to ride a bus so they aren't driving downtown and making things worse than they already are. So I think it's a great opportunity for us to get a one-tier system. It's a great opportunity for you to meet some of your concerns of your community of wanting more routes. We may find out when this study's done that it doesn't make sense for us to do it, and then that's fine. But I really believe when it's all done, it's going to be a good opportunity for the city and for the district to enter into this partnership. But we won't know that unless we do this second study.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I will. Sorry, one more thing.
Sure.
You're concerned about behaviors on the buses. I can tell you, when I first went to Des Moines, I was in charge of all of our 10 middle schools. During that time, I think it was 2 years before I took over a region, we had one child misbehave on a city bus. And that's middle school kids. And it was the same type of behavior that we would see on one of our yellow buses. So I really believe that our kids behave better when there were adults on the bus. So I'm not concerned about the behavior. I think we can come to some kind of agreement on behavior expectations, and we'll expect our kids to behave. That's understood. So I wouldn't let that be a concern for you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Brian. Any other questions before we let him go? All right, with that, we'll come up with the next item. But before we do that, I neglected to make sure everybody saw that we have a new city attorney sitting in the chair. Mr. Atkins was hiding in the back. Yeah, he's got the flu. Oh. Okay. I didn't know. I mean, he hasn't obviously given Mr. Jason tips on his time being the Garcia collection yet. But Jason, would you like to please tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get going with the next portion.
Sure. I came here from Portland, Oregon, which is where I was the last couple of years. Originally from Fargo, North Dakota, so I'm used to the cold. Kind of. Getting used to it, reacclimated to it, I guess. So I'm happy to be here.
Great. Thank you. Next part of number two on our list, the stormwater demonstration project on 3rd Street parking ramp. Megan, you're going to walk us through this?
Yeah, I am. Thank you for having me. I'm Megan Waller with Public Works. I'm here to talk about a stormwater demonstration project that we have in the works. In short, Public Works received an EPA Section 319 grant to improve the quality of the Zumbro River. And this program is unique. It allowed us an opportunity to identify a project area in the highly urban downtown core and an opportunity to demonstrate green infrastructure designs, benefits, maintenance opportunities in advance of all of the development and redevelopment that we have coming downtown. And so the objectives of the grant were, one, to produce a volume control feasibility map that is available on rochesterstormwater.com, where people can go in and click on their location and see what opportunities they have for stormwater management in that area. But the part that I'm here to talk about today is a demonstration site that we would put in within this project area that would be an educational tool for contractors, developers, and the general public, in addition to treating and managing stormwater runoff. And you've all taken my training, so I know you all know what we're talking about with stormwater runoff.
Yeah.
You know, we're concerned for the other people in the room. We'll take advantage of the opportunity. What's ever on our streets has a potential to end up in our stream. So we need to be...
Did you pick a slide that specifically shows the river being filthy at the particular time when it...
I did not pick these images were from the consultants, but, you know, whatever helps our cause. So whatever on our streets will end up in our streams, and oftentimes without treatment due to the stormwater infrastructure that was in place when the city grew. And we're doing so many different things to mitigate our impacts, but still more can be done, and when, again, through development and redevelopment, well,
perfect.
Okay. They like pictures. So.
Oh, yeah, well, I want you to see pictures. It helps things out here. So this was the project study area. Anything that we did for a demonstration project had to happen within this area per our grant application that we submitted. Again, it is one of the most dense places of the downtown area. So we settled on a retrofit of the 3rd Street ramp. So you can see in this image over here, we've got First Avenue, so we've got Potbelly's, Half Barrel. Across from that, in this area here, is what we're talking about. And so this demonstration site is going to take approximately 20,000 square feet of that parking ramp structure on the surface, capture that stormwater runoff, and intercept it at ground level, treat it on site, and demonstrate different stormwater management practices. There's also going to be opportunities to take stormwater runoff from the street, the water that's running down First Avenue, and turn it into this site that's outlined in red, and again, treat that stormwater runoff. It'll be used for stormwater education, demonstrating practical, innovative stormwater management strategies, showing people what can be done, encouraging people to look at stormwater as a potential amenity for their site, not something they just have to deal with, but be creative with, and how can they enhance their site. So we have two concepts, and that is why I'm here today, is to get some guidance on which one we should pursue of these two designs. We have our kind of an overview to help you gain your footing of where this would be placed. So it would be between the ramp and the street. There would be two lanes of north and southbound traffic, and parking would remain on the east side of that street. There is a difference in what parking exists depending on the design concept. So there's a lot going on in this pocket park, if you will, that demonstrates stormwater management techniques. We've got rainwater harvesting from the parking garage. There are curb cuts demonstrated here and here, where water from the street can flow in. There's infiltration trenches. There's rain gardens. There is a limestone stack that would demonstrate what's happening under our feet, kind of explode that geology up, and I'll touch more on that in just a second, but show people what's happening under our feet and some of the natural processes for cleaning stormwater runoff. Educational signage, some interactive water features, so whether it's sensors that trip and recycle the water that's been collected from the parking structure and held underground to then move through that site, so even on a bright sunny day, you can see how stormwater moves through the site and can be treated. Whether it's sensors or hitting a button. And then in this image, there would be 5 parking stalls that would have pervious pavers installed. So a stormwater management technique where water can infiltrate between those bricks, go down into the ground rather than run off. And the second concept, you can see it kind of laying in the street there, all of the parking spaces are incorporated into the demonstration project as vegetation, you know, treating on the surface via vegetation and some additional seating areas. So you can see, again, a list of the different features of stormwater management that are included in this design, or in both designs, rather. There is a public art component. So we have a stacked limestone feature that I had mentioned before, kind of exploding what's happening underneath our feet. You kind of see that sitting, an idea of how that would sit in the site. Depending on different bids that come in, there's an opportunity for a mural on that south wall, some shadow text on the south wall, so different opportunities for creating a bigger picture of what's happening with stormwater runoff, creating some connections and drawing attention in. Again, the goal here being an educational site, demonstrating the different things, encouraging people to wander over and understand how our streets and our landscapes are connected to the streams and the water quality of them. When talking about the public art component, it's important to point out that our artist, Jenna Didier, grew up in Rochester, playing on the banks of the Zumbro. She has a very strong connection with our town and with this waterway in particular. She is currently based out of Los Angeles, but she was the artist that came up with some of the concepts and will be working on that public art piece. The engagement that we've had to date, we were awarded this grant in 2015 and moved into the project phase, designing the project phase last year. And during that time, we've had meetings initially with the Art Center, the DMC, and the RDA. The Urban Prototyping Festival that happened last year was a big part of this idea. You know, I can see it moving throughout time. There were stormwater prototypes that were right out in front of this parking garage that helped demonstrate some of these concepts of how we treat and manage stormwater runoff. The artists went around door-to-door meeting with project neighbors. We had a Thursdays on First booth with the rain ribbons to come play in. I don't know if any of you had a chance to do that, but that was a big hit. Have had various interactions and presentations with different groups, such as the Energy Commission, the Downtown Neighborhood Association, and then went on a walkabout with Jenna from the RDA to meet with the project, the neighbors directly adjacent to the project, to talk about what our two concepts were and what their thoughts were on those different concepts. And I've included all the feedback that we got in that packet. Last weekend, we did have the free family day at the RAC. Over 250 people came out. And had a wide variety of different stormwater activities going on and had a chance to tell people we had envisioned for this stormwater site and chat about that project, and then have had various news releases and social media engagement. Project timeline, working on the final design of those construction documents, getting it out to bid. A project would start construction as soon as we can in April and would need to be finished up by the end of July due to the grant guidelines. And then once it is complete, have another engagement activity at the site. So I was asked to go fast and went fast.
You did.
So,
yeah, thank you.
Time for questions and clarifications.
Any questions for me? Mr. Bouguer.
I could probably ask this one to you, but between 1 and 2, which does the Downtown Neighborhood Association prefer?
The Downtown Neighbors, not to put words in their mouth based off of my memory, per the letter of the Downtown Neighborhood Association president, highlights of their letter, concept was well received, support was tempered by the loss of valuable street parking serving both the local businesses and residents at 318 Common. Concern was magnified as the design solutions for the 4th Street reconstruction project. DNA strongly supports the entrepreneurial community and welcomes the addition of the food truck units to our neighborhood. We would see this as a successful design only if nightly food truck parking is maintained as part of the final implementation.
So one.
I assume that would be the most popular, more popular with the businesses as well.
And this is permanent, maybe?
It is permanent.
Mr. Mayor.
I can't visualize it as well as maybe it really is, but the artwork on the south wall of the ramp, there's another big building that's almost adjacent. Mm-hmm. Maybe there is enough room in there that you really see it. At first it just seemed like, yeah, that picture, are you really going to get that whole picture when you have the other building that's several stories high too?
Yeah, and when we did walk around, kind of looking at different site angles, and there's opportunity there, and that again is a bit alternate, so The ideas have been put out there, but not the specifics exactly of what that would look like.
So despite the downtown neighbors having that opinion, I prefer the one with more seating. I found that to be having been down to Thursdays on First enough times, the lack of shaded seating available, especially for people that may not be used to 110 degrees at ground level when they're out during some of those months. I think having some options here that would introduce new seating is a good one. And especially year round, because when Thursdays at First is in there, then there's almost, there's very little seating out there available. It would be nice if we could figure out a place to put the food trucks that would kind of still keep them in this vicinity. Do we have any parking on the alternate side? No. This is the driveway out of the ramp is the end of the parking on the street to the corner, right?
There actually, I think, are a couple.
There's two or three stalls.
Stalls.
Perfect. So, problem solved.
You still have dining on the other side of the street.
I just solved the problem, and I got my parking, and I got my new benches. So I'm with one, and we redesignate those stalls on the end of the block to be food truck parking.
Well, and don't forget, we did say we'd bring the food truck back at a later date. And I know there's a lot of groups that have some input on that, and that'll be discussed at a later date. So this should just be about this project here, which, if you prefer one or two.
I like one with my asterisk.
Any other comments for me?
Actually, like two.
Two, yeah, sorry.
He likes two. He likes two.
I wasn't going to say anything. Why'd you correct him?
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions for Megan? Any direction you wish to...
Sooner is better.
Mr. Hickey says he prefers two.
Everything else is the same except...
What do you want?
I'd go with one personally.
I'm sorry.
Everything else is the same except whether one has five parking spaces...
And two has...
And the other one has five benches.
And it is important to note that the stormwater treatment volume is the same between the two. These pervious pavers do capture... stormwater runoff. It shows a different BMP offers. I think the DMC had put it as, could it be repurposed in multiple different ways, pop-ups and whatnot. So, but really most of the people we talked to in the engagement favored one or the other. But that was a question asked about treatment.
Megan, Richard, have we looked at, you're talking about the paver, or being able to put it on the parking area. Have we run into issues with any of that stuff?
Yeah, the pavers work well.
They do work
well.
Yes,
the porous pavement has not worked well.
Okay.
The pavers themselves.
So you do pavers here.
You notice on this drawing that we have met with the RDA and we've met with the some of the entertainers that basically utilize the stage to make sure that we're not impacting the stage location, the location of speakers, and everything else. So there's been a lot of due diligence here to make sure that either one of these options works.
So that's the important point, is even this one, we would make sure that the Thursdays on First stage had a place to land in there that had a spot that worked great on Thursdays, and then every other day of the week it didn't look like something was missing from that.
Mr. Camp?
Can we go back to one?
Of course.
I would move that the consensus of the council is to do design concept one. Anyone dissent?
Mr. Hickey, what would you like? Because you were favoring two.
I agree with one. Pretty agreeable, so.
Pretty agreeable. Okay, so let it be shown that, Ms. Johnson, are you agreeable?
I'm agreeable, yes.
Okay, so let it be shown that the council, those who are in attendance would say one, what they would like to have a consensus on.
I'm just going to have a bench in front of us.
How's that?
Those who are in attendance. History is decided by those who show up.
That's right. You participate, you win, you don't choose.
I actually like design one for a completely different reason than everyone else, and that's just that very question about does this technology work? I mean, it demonstrates this.
You're right.
And I also feel like just the fact that we were talking about pervious and impervious surfaces, we should have just called Sandra and had her come.
So we're good with this item?
Yep. Okay.
All righty.
Thank you,
Megan. Third topic, everybody's favorite. Mitzi, are you coming up here? Oh boy, she brought a whole bunch of people. All right.
Just on the before we jump into the third,
sure.
Can we on the first topic is that?
Okay, Jeff, Mr. Wojcik has a comment on the first
topic. On the first topic, is that is the contract coming to the council at the next meeting for a vote?
I don't think it needs to go to the council, the dollar amount, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
it can be done as a virtual
contract. Yeah. We have the ability to.
Well, and I just don't know if there were. I'm supportive of going forward, but I don't know there was consensus, so I don't. I want to make sure that.
In case I wasn't clear, I'm a no. So.
Okay. Yes.
For what?
Going back to the first one on the bus.
But I'm saying if we brought it to.
Doing the second.
But if we brought it to an evening meeting, we
would have no problem.
Right.
Yeah, vote
to an RCA, right?
Right.
So will it be?
We can bring it to the next meeting.
Perfect.
I mean, we can also, because of the dollar amount, we can approve it by consensus if there's four yeses here anyway, and then we get a week's head start.
I would prefer it come as an RCA.
Okay.
Yeah.
We will delay it a week.
We'll bring it to the,
next meeting. Yep, absolutely.
All right. Mitzi, Mr. Reimer, you guys have been working on this. Do you want any explanation needed before we get started?
Want to just walk through the process for today? Just so it's clear for everyone.
I think that would be a very wise thing.
My understanding is the intent for today is to look at Section 3 and to focus in on the policies and simply highlight the ones that you're going to want to pull for discussion at a subsequent meeting. I'm hoping we can have full council for discussion.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's the way I understood it, Mr. Hickey.
So it seems like we're going to have to do this again when we have everybody here. So.
Well, I think... Rustin has provided us at least the items that he would like discussed, so we could come back with at least the ones highlighted, so we're more focused.
And I guess my feeling is at least if we pick some out that have some issues, it gives Mitzi and her staff some chance to look at and come up with. They do have some of the writings of the people who disagree and why, so it gives them some ideas. Mr. Wojcik.
So I want to keep pushing. I'd like a date that we're driving towards right now, because it looks like February 1st is blown up, which will push us into our 27th month. What is the current date that we're driving towards actually getting this up for a vote?
Mr. Reimer, do we have... I don't know if we really have one, to be honest. Until we can walk through this and figure it out, where the discrepancies are and where we can get people happy with them, I don't know if we have a vote. I think the thing that we can do is say we're going to keep pushing it. This thing doesn't fall off the list until we get it done.
Well, I mean, it's...
I know, Mike, but I don't know. Unfortunately, I thought we were going to have everyone here. I wasn't expecting to sit here either, so...
This is, you know, we've had several meetings where people aren't there when we need them there, and
this is one of those things where we need the council here to talk, because we have to get 5 votes, and so... It's going to just take the
time,
Mr. Campion.
Yep, I agree. Let's move through it. I'm not going to let this become an obstruction where we just continually wait for people to put this forward, so let's go through it, whatever people have.
Go ahead, Mitzi.
And I would suggest that we skip past the introductory part. We've
pretty much editing that out.
Because it was repetitive. So if we can just go right to the goals and policy section, it would be helpful if we can just step through number one and see if anyone has a sub-item there that they want pulled, and then go to 2 and 3.
Mr. Hickey.
So I question the format of just how we're doing this. So I understand it's like a rough draft from the staff sat down as an exercise to put some tick marks and say, what are the policies we're going to bring forward to the council? Do these planning principles apply? You kind of do a scorecard and say, yeah, I think these apply. These are the ones, these are the winners, these are the policies that are coming forth. But now that this isn't a rough draft anymore, what is the purpose of the tick marks? I mean, if there's one tick mark, it's a pretty good policy. If there's 7 tick marks, it's really good. I don't see the value of having the tick marks.
Earlier feedback we received from council, we actually already went in, and I think I conveyed this at some point, and we took out the table on the side with the policy and the tick marks.
Perfect.
Just focused on the words.
All right. Guess I'm still in the November 17th draft. So.
Right. Well, and I did ask the council if you wanted us to distribute
that's fine.
And I was told not to.
Yeah, we don't want to distribute
that's fine.
We did do that at the last meeting.
Perfect.
But
right.
The wording is
the
same, though.
Question.
Hey, you're one for one.
Yeah.
See? This is going great.
All right. Mitzi, please continue.
Okay, so can I just find out if anyone has objections? objection or concern with items in goal number one or the sub items underneath that?
Mark?
Yes, Mr. Hickey.
So I got a question on 1-9. So what's a network level asset management approach? It's just a question.
Well, I think what that is it's taking a look at, especially with infrastructure, whether it's streets or utilities, you have an entire system, and when you're looking at the asset management, making sure that you're maintaining that with a system's perspective, and prioritizing where your limited resources are going, and try to manage that.
So when you say a network, what are you defining as a network? A network of streets, a network of, what are we talking about?
Well, it could be streets, but it could be sidewalks. It could be trails.
All right.
Transit, right. You're thinking transit network. I mean, it's
it
any.
Could be anything.
But it could be other systems, too.
Could be sewer. Could be water. Could be any of the
infrastructure. Which is just transit for other stuff.
Any other questions on one? Any of the subsections of one? That answer your question, Mark?
It does.
One?
Thank you.
And just to further add to that, that approach is what we'll be looking at taking, you know, throughout all of our different infrastructure. So from buildings to parks, just looking things a little more holistically. So as we do bring things forward, you can see them in the big picture and then the priorities. So I'd say it's consistent with where we want to go, regardless of the comp plan language right there.
Okay.
Okay, let's move on to two. And how is it? Mr. Hickey.
I think everybody else voted for this, every word of it, so I guess I'm going to be the guy with the questions. 2.1, so we're going to ensure that all people have fair and equal access to adequate, affordable housing now and in the future. So how are we doing that in the comp plan?
Well, the plan isn't focused on how exactly the community provides affordable housing, but in terms of the physical development of the community and the overarching policy of trying to diversify housing types, styles, and cost ranges, looking at our older neighborhoods where we have some of our most affordable housing and trying to reinvest in those with programs like community development block grant rehab programs, and then also combining the land use and transit strategies so that you can support more places where there's a lower total cost of living. It may not be the total cost of housing, but the total cost of living can be reduced by reducing transportation expenses. It can help households.
So as I go through these policies, I kind of think that this is eventually going to get translated in like the land development manual. We're going to have ordinances that actually say this is how we're going to accomplish this. So I'm just trying to picture how that would work.
Well, I think you hit on something very important there, is many of these things will translate to a formal policy that comes back to the council. There's formal action, whether you're setting up a whole new program around affordable housing or you're adopting an ordinance that allows for something specific. This document doesn't do that. That's a subsequent action.
Mr. Campion.
Yeah, so I think that's maybe understanding that's a little bit divergent, is the comp plan has a broader scope than simply zoning. So putting aspirational things in there can also set the table for other initiatives we might be taking on as a city, like our involvement in the, what's the name of the
coalition?
The coalition, if I can use that that as an example of how we're tackling affordable housing. I mean, there's going to be a lot of components to what we do, TIF, how we apply TIF. All of that can be under the guise of this comprehensive plan, correct?
Correct. You know, when I read 2.1, the city isn't the only agency or entity that's pursuing some support for affordable housing, and if the word ensure is too strong, you could simply change it to support. It may be difficult for the city to ensure that. We have social service agencies and nonprofits that are working in different ways to help support ensuring that.
Any other comments?
What would you like it to read?
I just ask him.
Okay, I mean,
are you comfortable with ensure, Mark, or would you be more comfortable with support?
So again, it's hard to imagine. So we're not going to go through this all again when there's the other two members.
I hope not, but we'll see. I can't promise.
Hopefully the fact that they weren't here means they'll send us their concerns.
Well, I would hope that, you know, as we've heard, Mitzi has said Mr. Ruska has sent his issues in. They've all talked about it. So I think we're kind of looking here to try to come to some common ground and comfort zone for all. So, I mean, I guess my question for you, Mark, as Mitzi has asked, is insure okay with you? Okay with insure? Would you like to see it say support?
Sure, that's fine. So just, you know, to take it back up a notch, just something, I mean, this came to a vote, surprisingly, how many weeks ago, but just things like in this document that the appendices aren't even defined, that we were going to approve it. We were approving appendices that weren't even defined yet. I mean, what part of the process do the appendices get defined? And are they there and just not printed yet? If we were going to approve this, it seems like we should have everything we're approving in writing, right?
Right. And we knew that when this came to you from the Planning Commission, there probably were going to be some edits to clean up. And as a matter of fact, you know, we had recommendations from the Planning Commission. We heard comments at that public hearing. We've received other comments since then. We're waiting for a collection of comments from the council so that we can refresh this document, trim it up, and bring it back to you with a text-edited version so you can see where the changes were, so that it's ready for adoption.
But we haven't even seen a draft of the appendices yet, right?
No, and actually, those are not part of the plan. They were simply supporting background information, if I remember right.
Yep.
They're really not part of the plan itself.
It's all the background stuff we've gotten as far as population projections, more details about the public meetings that we held, things like that.
Okay.
And they can be deleted. They're not the plan itself.
All right. Any other comments on section two? Mr. Hickey.
So 2.3, support housing in locations that contribute to a neighborhood, sense of community, and a welcome and inclusive residential environment. So again, what does that mean? We're going to support housing. We're going to provide TIF. We're going to zone it in such a way. What are we talking about?
It could be all of the above. It can be read broadly, but I think part of what that's saying is being conscious not to approve housing in locations that are in conflict with adjacent land uses or that are isolated from being part of a neighborhood.
Okay. Anything else in two? Nothing else in two? All right, let's move to three. Maintaining the community's commitment to health, wellness, and environment. Any questions on three, Mr. Hickey?
I pretty much have a question on everything in three.
Okay, well, let's start working from 3.1 and work through it.
So again, looking at the comprehensive plan, so employing health in all policy, you know, health in all policy approach to major policy implementation decisions. What does that mean?
It's a recognition that decisions that you make on a day-to-day basis can influence and impact community health and individual health outcomes. So even though we have major medical facilities in our community, a very small amount of time is spent in those clinic walls by individuals. Much of their time is in the community. How we design and operate and maintain our facilities and where they're provided and whether they're provided influences whether or not individuals have access to transportation, to jobs, to education, how they move about the community, whether it's safe or unsafe, whether they have access to parks and open space.
So I can see access to parks. That's making sense to me. But how we're going to plan our road networks and transportation, housing, I don't see how that's health.
Concept of health in all policy is actually spread throughout all different industry of planning and engineering, public works, parks and rec, almost every public sector.
I agree with parks and rec, that I understand.
Right? And I've worked very closely with physicians at Mayo Clinic and actually have delivered curriculum together with them on the impacts of health in the built environment. And working with the physician who is also the public health director, we've delivered some presentations at national locations on that subject, and it's very well embraced across many different professions, that many of these things about our physical environment have impacts on health and health outcomes.
Okay,
and I'd be happy to schedule a session on that topic for you at some point if you'd like.
Mr. Wojcik.
So, you know, part of this, and when I was looking into this, I didn't even realize this at first, but the county health board, it's a joint city-county health board, and I was not aware of that for a long time. But some of these things that we don't necessarily think about day-to-day, we have different parts of local government that is really focusing on that. And a lot of this entire section, a lot of this comes out of the work that they've been doing and their input to the comprehensive plan as well. But I was just at a... I'm trying to remember who the physician was, and I don't know if you were there, Mitzi, but we had a physician from Mayo say that the built environment is every bit as important to health outcomes as diet and exercise and other common things. That Urban Land Institute, which is an organization by developers for developers, also have an entire focus on building healthy places and healthy corridors initiatives as well, and these are literally how you design a city will affect people's health, and not just the access to the green space, but just how the mix of uses such that it's going to promote walkability, transit access, walkability to the transit. So I do think there's a lot of things in here, but if the overall issue is whether or not health belongs in the comprehensive plan, I think that's maybe an aside that maybe some time could be spent with the community health board or with some of these other, just provide us some of these other materials, because I know there's a lot of scientific backing for these various things that are in here.
Mr. Hickey.
Yes, I've shared my concerns with 3-1. If no one else has anything, we go to 3-2. What does it mean to improve household access to healthy food, and how's that in the comprehensive plan?
I think this is one that came up in another discussion and might benefit from some additional explanation. We were asked, does this mean that if a housing development wants to go in a certain location but there's not a full-service grocery store nearby, that they can't establish housing there? That's not what it means. You could decide that's what it means if you want to change the zoning ordinance to make that a site location requirement. I don't anticipate that's going to happen. But that's where you have to make that change and make it very clear. This plan won't do that. Improve household access to healthy food can include anything from supporting neighborhood gardens. Parks and Rec and our neighbors have worked together to identify some unused parts of parks where neighborhood gardens can be established. Can be supporting farmers markets, can be supporting the transit system development that helps people more conveniently get to where they want to go to get that healthy food. It's broad. It can mean a number of different things.
All right. I still have concerns about 3-2.
Okay, so please make a mark by 3-2 so we can come back and we have the full council and other discussion. 3-3.
3-1 for that matter. Pretty much everything
okay.
In 3.
So 3 will be an area we'll be coming back to. So 3-3, that's another area, Mark, that would be just as easy to bring back to the council as a whole and try to have that discussion?
Yeah, I'm going to have questions. However we want to talk about it or wait for other members or whatever you want to do, but I've got concerns about 3 in general.
So the entirety of 3.
I mean, reduce emissions generated from electricity. I mean, how are we doing that in our comprehensive plan?
Well, why don't we just mark that off for a discussion with when we get the full council and continue on. What's the council think?
The criticism I hear is how are we doing that in a comprehensive plan? But
I don't think it belongs in the comprehensive plan.
So you don't think it is, you don't like it as a priority for the city? I guess my point is, if not everything we see here is going to be covered in the comprehensive plan, this is a broad document that covers all the agencies of the city. So it's not simply a zoning document. How are we reducing emissions generated from electricity through changes in supply? I'm sure I can reach out to RPU and they can explain all about how they were doing that reduction already. But it is about restating our priorities as a community. This is what this document does. Not everything is itemized within the document itself.
Mr. Wood?
I don't like the approach that we'll tackle this when we get the council together, because that was the purpose of this meeting. I would instead like to get the specific... What I'd really like to get is I'd like to get what the requests for action would be to make it tenable to those that are here. And then if those that aren't here have other requests that they'd like to see, they can add that at a later date. But rather than putting off the whole discussion for a meeting, which is what this meeting is, I would rather get the get some proposals for how we'd like to address this on the table so that we can take action.
So, Mark, do you have any that you would have a recommendation how they should be worded, or are your concerns more than they should be scratched?
I'd probably scratch them. So the thing is, I recognize that that's the whole point. If we don't have consensus to do it, no one's going to make any changes based on my one. And I know how the other four feel. So, again, I'm trying to understand the exercise today.
I may make changes to support you if they're reasonable changes. I don't want that to be an assumption that we're going to work from. Right. And so I think that there's plenty here. But partly it's getting people to put the cards on the table about how they actually feel about these different aspects, because there's a lot of slowness right now, it's feeling like. We had a meeting back in with a vote that some people didn't like that happened. And then we had, you know, 60 days now to get these out. And we're trying to just plod through this. So if this is what we have to do, if we have to plod through it to get these out, then let's do it so that we can do it and move forward.
I'll add, too, that I am absolutely willing. Part of the reason why I want to push these things and get them out on the table is so that I know if I can support them or not. And that's my intent in being here.
Mitzi.
So I don't know if we need to discuss each one today or simply which policy items you want us to discuss at the next meeting so we come back prepared and have them highlighted and we're ready to roll through them. There are different ways to do this. We're just looking to move forward.
All righty. Let's just keep plodding along. Let's see, because we have some that we're not coming back to. Four. Any discussion on use of development vision to define the city's character, Mark?
4-1. What does that mean?
Well, I think it's recognizing that we have a community made up of people, and we need to keep that at the forefront as we're designing spaces and we're making investments. Recognizing that we need to accommodate for buildings, vehicles, transit vehicles, freight, and all kinds of different things within our community. But at the heart of it, we are a community of people, and we can design to accommodate those things and do it in a more human-centered way. So being more pedestrian-friendly, making sure that we don't compromise on some of the green space amenities that complement the buildings and the transportation systems that we have generally.
Comments? Comfortable with that, Mark?
Sounds good.
All right.
Hey, baby steps, we'll take it.
4-2. Okay. Let's move on to 5. Integrated land use and transportation planning. Any questions? Comment, Mark, Mr. Hickey.
So in 5-2, we're working towards reducing the rate of growth of vehicle miles and travel and dependence on automobile. This kind of goes back to what I've talked about before. You know, we look at like the DMC plan or the complete streets, all things at a high level that make really good sense. For example, the DMC plan talks about we don't have the capacity to expand, you know, the road network downtown. We can't add lanes based on our right of way. But when we get to the actual implementation, a lot of times what I see is we're choking down and removing transportation lanes. So my concern is things at a high level are fine, but then the actual implementation, and the one I've talked about recently, is that presentation for the 4th Street. I mean, that's not giving people additional options for transportation. It's choking it down. So how are we going to reduce the rate of growth? Are we choking down automobile lanes? Are we, you know, trying to force people onto public transportation by making their driving experience untenable? Or are we really going to add to people's options? And that's kind of my concern about all this. We say like complete streets. We want to give people more options for transportation, to take transit or to bike. But a lot of times, the actual reality of it is we're choking down and taking away, we're trying to choke off automobile options. So that's my concern. Where are we going?
So on a high level, this is really speaking to an overarching strategy of making sure we're using land use and transportation planning together, that our transit system is going to be a key piece to helping to make it easier for people to choose transit should they want to, if they're nearby, and that transit line is running frequently, and also that the park and ride system is a very essential piece to making this work. Reducing the rate of growth doesn't say that we're going to reduce the number of people who drive, simply the rate at which the vehicle miles driven is growing. And that the approach in the plan is really to diversify choices and make other choices convenient and easy and safe.
So when you say that, I completely agree with everything you're saying, but that's not what we do in practice. So how do we ensure that our intent gets conveyed from the high level down to what we actually do?
So the strategies you can use to achieve this can vary, and some communities may take much more aggressive approaches, and whether you're choking down streets or converting lanes is a decision made at an implementation stage, and that's where that probably needs to be vetted further. I think how this gets conveyed is going to differ over time with the different councils we have and the different design advances that come forward.
Mr. Wojak, then Mr. Campion.
Well, I would say I don't actually think we're as far off as you might think on this one. A couple of things I would point to is part of the reason we're having that discussion on 4th Street is you have to remember 4th Street doesn't, on the west side, doesn't connect to the broader community. It goes over and you have to get on 6th Street, which is the choke point. And we can't expand 6th Street, so 6th Street is 6th Street. And we can't expand, we're never going to get significantly more traffic on 4th Street. It's actually not intended to be an arterial. The other one that I point to is 2nd Street Southwest, where, you know, sounding like what the plans are going to be in the future is two automobile lanes and two transit lanes, which significantly moves much more people through that same amount of space.
That makes the assumption that we've made the mode shift.
Yes,
it
does.
So if you're moving empty buses, then you're not. That's what we do today.
But in this particular case, though, what I would say is that you're right, it assumes the mode shift, but it's also not a physical change that takes place until that mode shift is there. So it's not limiting us. So I would say that I'm not entirely, I think that this is compatible with what we're doing right now. It's when we look at things like Broadway, that it's going to be more of a, and you know, Broadway, the plan is to maintain four lanes.
Mr. Campion.
I heard that generally we're all in agreement with the policy here. It's about the approach to executing the policy, which I think is when we should tackle how, if we all agree that it's important for our community to reduce the rate of growth in vehicle miles, that's literally all we have to agree on to move past this point. When it comes to your implementation concerns, which I agree, you're allowed to have those implementation concerns and we should talk about those. It just isn't germane to whether or not we agree with 5.2. It's, do we agree with reducing the rate of growth of vehicle mile lanes? You may have one approach, I'll have another, but if we agree that it should be reduced, that's enough to agree that this is a policy for the city, in my mind.
And I believe that the land development manual space is when we will have the struggles on exactly how this happens. Mr. Hickey.
So we talk about this being a policy document, and again, whether it's at the front of the document, I think we need to more clearly articulate what our policy is as far as to provide transportation choices. So we've got some documents down the line that have not done this, have not implemented the complete street policy the way I think it should be. And the example we keep coming back to is the bicycle master plan that I think we all agree is outmoded, yet here we are continuing to restripe roads based on this. So again, if someone could tell me, here's the network and this is how it all works and it's up to date, but we're making this mode shift to provide empty bicycle lanes while we're choking down traffic. So where we've done it has not served the city well. So 41st Street is a good example. Going out by the rack is a good example. You're trying to force a mode shift that we're not ready for yet.
Mr. Camp.
And I think my rebuttal would again be, as a supermajority of the council, the goal here is to set the policy and to set the direction. And when it comes down to individual implementations like that, that's oftentimes picking between two good options. We saw today, I fought for one park design and I lost. And the net is, it's still a win for the city because we got a new park downtown. I think there's a lot of those that are going to come up where we have to default back to the goal. We all agree that the goal is to reduce the amount of, and I want to make sure I use the language correctly, vehicle miles traveled.
The rate of growth.
The rate of growth, excuse me. Yes.
There's a difference.
Thank you for correcting me. You are absolutely right. There is a difference. But if we can agree on that, I think then we have a different policy debate about, or a different discussion about each project and about whether or not it's meeting that goal. It's not about, there's no one size fits all for that that's going to fit every possible plan that's going to come forward. And if we don't establish this as the goal, we have no common ground to speak of.
So I don't know what the mechanism is, but the words here are fine. If we need clear guidance at the front of the document, you know, what our intent is, I know what my intent is. So,
well, maybe when you say clear in the front, I mean, is it something like a statement where these general policies are refined through implementation documents, or?
So, for example, I keep going back to the bicycle master plan. So, yep. Public Works just sent out the next round of restriping based on the outdated bicycle master plan. So, is that our intent? Maybe it is. It's certainly not mine. But yet, based the staff saying, "Hey, this is the plan of record. Mm-hmm. This is the policies you set. We're just implementing them."
Yeah.
And here we go.
We're doing community land use on a 40-year outdated plan, too. So I get that part, but. In this particular part right now, I mean, is there some specific language that you'd want to put at the front? Or
I'm saying that wording is absolutely correct. It's perfect.
Okay.
It's what we do.
Well, I know. We got to go to 5-3 first. Any question on 5-3? Then let's go to 6. Okay, we're at 6.
If you want to jump to 11, we could save some time. I don't think
all right. That works for me.
Nice work there, Mr.
All right, number 11.
I just had some questions more than anything else.
Okay, which?
11-2.
11-2?
So again, my whole idea on these mode shifts, they should be incentivized instead of through, you know, it should be the carrot instead of the stick. Mm-hmm. And we're doing a lot more stick lately than carrot. So what does it mean to develop and implement policies? I mean, what are we doing here?
So one of the things actually underway right now is the development of the Transportation Management Association, and it's made up of downtown employers. Mayo's on that committee, but we have a lot of other employers in our downtown, and they're coming together to help support an organization that will help to market, to promote, other choices, travel choices, whether it's carpooling, it's park and ride, it's regional bus, or if it's walking or biking. And they're going to provide information to the human resources departments for those different organizations and work with the employees to help support choices.
One of those two.
Not one of them, yeah.
The food.
So it's putting the carrots out there and saying, here are some choices that you can make, and maybe there are some incentives for you to do that or some rewards for you. But I think the other thing we have to recognize is we have a major employer in our downtown who is a very influential partner in helping us with this motion. They don't provide parking to all their employees, and if they did, we would have been filled with parking in our downtown right now.
I think this is an idea that Mr. Wojcik has talked about before, which is that's a good one. So if you gave people a choice, you have the parking space, you can have cash.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden, people might be making some different choices. But there's an example of giving people choices. People like choices.
You're giving me too much credit because I got that from staff who got it from Seattle Children's Hospital.
There's an example.
So are you okay with this language?
Yeah, these are mostly, I just have questions.
Okay.
Okay. Which next one?
Good on the next. 11-4 I'm good on because now I know what we're talking about. 11-5 Just explain to me what you mean by this.
Okay, this is getting a little bit techy, but from the federal and state levels down, we have functional classifications for different roadways within our transportation system. So they might be primary arterials, they might be secondary arterials, there might be collector roadways, freeways, highways, etc. This is identifying, we have these major facilities that we have to maintain and keep intact and respect those. And looking at that from a systems perspective, just trying to enforce that and reinforce those investments that are in place. Sometimes that's going to mean reinvesting in them to maintain them. And in other instances, it might be simply making a decision not to put something next to it because you know that's a major investment that's going to continue to be there. The thing that wants to go next to it might not be compatible with it.
Okay.
I was say, in general, I think you'd like that one more than me. So.
There you go.
Okay. Mark, next one.
Let's see. Same thing, 11.6 is kind of the concern I had before. So again, it's...
Execution.
Right, exactly. It's execution. So... If we're incentivizing people and giving people more options, I like it. If we're trying to punish people and make, you know, driving downtown a horrible experience, then, you know, I'm going to have concerns.
So, and I'm going to ask staff a follow-up on that. Do you feel like this is embodied elsewhere within this document where we're codifying execution-level details that we need to visit as part of this? I'm thinking back because I did read it now a while ago, but I don't remember us getting into the nitty gritty of what the kind of project level detail this would be setting.
I'd have to go back and look. Typically, in a comp plan, there's very little project level detail you're going to get into. I think again, this is really programmatic oriented statement, and in other strategies that might be ordinances or parking pricing. Almost every one of these things is going to come back to the front of the council for decision and execution.
And we would come to a point where we would say, like, this is the goal we agreed on. Now we have multiple ways to achieve that. What's the way forward here? And Councilmember Hickey can advocate for the idea of more choices, which I think is a venerable position.
I think you hit on it. The intent here is that when you have big decisions and other things that come forward to you, you should be asking, is it consistent with the community's vision and our overarching objectives and goals? What was it? Does it move it closer to us? Does it move us closer to them or further from it? And that's a discussion point for this body.
Okay. Other comments on 11? Or 11.6? Anything?
You can jump right to 14.1 if you want.
Do you want to leave that one highlighted?
I don't think it's going to get fixed at these levels. So.
Okay.
Let's move to 14.
See, I'm just trying to minimize the work.
I've got a question.
Okay, Mr. Hickey.
So 14.1. So, again, I think this is a made-up distinction. I mean, we see places in town, we've got the 16-foot wide recreational path, and then we've got bike lanes, and then we've got vehicle lanes. I mean, this idea that there's two different kinds of bicyclists and they can't mix or they shouldn't mix or whatever. I mean, I'm not sure why we're making policies to accommodate that. There you go.
Comment?
I just compare that to the Sunday driver to the over the road trucker.
So they give them.
They just use the systems differently, and they're.
So we give them two different road networks, so they don't have to be on the same roads, or.
Well, we do restrict over the road truckers to certain areas, certain roadways. The thing I would point out is that if in fact there's a way of separating the pedestrians from the cyclists, that's one thing. But most of the time, when you're talking about paths, there's two distinctions that come into play. One, people are walking their dogs on that, and the leash is so long, and people are going in both directions. You've got corners. That's one, and which is, there are some folks, you know, kids that might go on a ride under those conditions, but there are other people who are going 15, 20 miles per hour, that if they get into that situation, there's harm that comes as a result of that. And the second thing is, I kind of chuckle when people talk about the on Highway 14, the paths being next to the lanes, because that's great, except the paths don't go anywhere. And they kind of truncate right at Broadway, or at least they did recently. And there's, you know, whereas when you have a on-road or next-to-road facility, they actually get you all the way through the corridor. And, you know, and we see that. You can go out there, shift change at Seneca, and see people even using those lanes, because on some parts there's not even sidewalks on along those streets. So I would say that the big picture, we can look at this on a case-by-case basis, which is something we have the ability to do. But I think we're kind of oversimplifying when you're going to put cyclists who are going to otherwise choose a lane of traffic and gun through an area with a lot of pedestrians and dogs and kids riding bikes.
Mitzi, would you suggest any modification to that language?
So again, I think it's, you're providing facilities for bicycles. I mean, I don't see the distinction.
Mr. Campbell?
Maybe highlight it. I mean, that's really what this comes down to, is the distinction a policy level point that we want to make.
Okay, so highlighting.
I don't have an opinion.
Yeah.
2. Or 14.1, excuse me.
I think you got the exact words. I mean, it's basically, do you include those or do you not include those? Mm-hmm. And do we consider this as more of a implementation level detail of whether or not we're going to do that? That's kind of what you're getting at.
Yep.
Yeah. 14.5, I think you've probably heard me talk about this before. I've got concerns about the 2012 Bicycle Master Plan. I ask that it's been reviewed. We haven't been able to do that. It's out of date, and I don't think it's served us well.
Maybe that should actually suggest that we update that plan.
I think that would be a very good idea.
Yeah, all the planning staff's on this. No, that's, I completely agree with that point for probably completely different reasons that plan needs to be updated.
Ms. Johnson?
Can we switch that to current bicycle plan instead of 2012?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to have a year on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
No, we have to leave it, so we have to get a
supermajority. Well, it doesn't make sense
for change the year.
Right. Does that help, Mr. Rickey?
What's that?
Does that help?
No, but that's okay.
Oh.
I mean, we're going to update it. Yeah, that we agree. Yep.
Okay. 15, or is there, do we want to skip somewhere?
I mean, okay, so hold on.
All right. Well, here I thought it was.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may. Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
I mean, the inclusion of the point is actually a problem to me, now that it's brought up in this thing, is that is our implementation guide. So calling out that we need to update it is kind of superfluous. I mean, literally, that is what we do to enact the policies of the comprehensive plan. So we should just drop that bullet. And
move. Right, let me throw it a different way.
Okay, what, Mr. Woja.
What if we just say maintain an up to date Rochester Bicycle Master Plan?
Ms. Johnson.
I was simply changing.
It doesn't direct us.
2012 out and not putting the update part. Just continue to implement the recommendations of the current Rochester Bicycle Master Plan.
I fully respect that, and my point is completely different. Mine
I
is
missed
the plan. The Bike Master Plan is the step we take to implement the policies of the comprehensive plan and how they apply to the bicycling. So to say to do this is to call out something that we do as the very nature of being council members. I don't think it's important that it's in this document.
There's no, and here's what I say, there is no legal requirement to maintain a bicycle master plan.
Which would be, I mean, dereliction of your responsibility as a council
member. Very much so, but because if we can at least agree that we should have one, we could hopefully agree on a point that we should maintain an up-to-date one.
Master plan is actually a part of your comprehensive plan. It is a more detailed systems analysis of a specific mode. So, for bicycling, we have a more detailed systems plan. The statement doesn't need to be in here in order for us to continue to implement.
implement it. So I think, to your point, we could drop it and it wouldn't really matter.
Perfect. I would support dropping it because I think the rest of these are clearly policy driven. I think that one is more of like a footnote that we should go take care of another thing we need to do.
Well, I don't like the update part. I mean, it was a...
So we're talking about scratching 14.5.
It gets rid of a point of contention. We know we're going to do it anyway, and it's going to... So.
I think we could do that by consensus, and you can just delete it now.
Well, we're going to have to review this version eventually.
Hey, the less yellow that's on here, the less we're reviewing.
Yeah, I agree.
So just delete it.
So we're going to delete it by consensus.
Perfect. Thank you.
15. Comments on 15? Mr. Hickey?
No, we can just jump right to 16.
All right.
So again, this is kind of a philosophical thing. So out of, I mean, even this plan recognizes for the foreseeable future through the, you know, this plan, vehicle use, we're looking to, you know, limit the expansion of it, but it's going to be the predominant form of travel. So out of this whole plan, we've got three bullets that talk about facilitating the efficient, you know, motorized travel, and two out of three of them talk about we're going to, you know, mitigate the impacts of the automobile. And I just, again, I just question that. Right? So number 16.1 looks great. Mm-hmm. But like 16.2 and 16.3, we're talking about mitigating, you know, the impact of automobiles. I just don't think this plan recognizes enough that, you know, we're going to have vehicle travel or private automobile travel for the foreseeable future.
So, the thing that we're not supposed to call the executive summary that we, I don't know what we call that document, but that. Are you conceptually in agreement with that document at this point?
Yeah, I just highlight this because I just think it's interesting. All these policies, there's three that talk about the efficient motorized travel, and two out of three talk about mitigating the impact of the automobile. I'm just making an observation.
Well, and ultimately, what I'm kind of getting at though is that if the bones of the plan that we agreed on conceptually are okay, and to Nick's point, if it, you know, either merge these or change the, you know, as long as we keep it consistent with that other part, because I think that other part is what we're trying to do.
Let's see.
So I'm looking at 16.3. Yep. I don't read that as being specific to other modes being favored over automobile traffic. And part of what this gets us to is we have access management strategies and managing how frequently we can have driveway openings on certain roadways, collectors, arterials, and so forth. We also have traffic impact reports that are required, mitigation of the increased traffic, whether it's turn lanes or signal changes, timing changes. It's really encompassing of a whole set of strategies overarching that we should be taking care to implement.
Mr. Campion.
How about, bear with me here.
I'm not looking for any changes. I'm just talking.
Maybe.
Okay, you keep going. Right.
Okay, well, we're getting close to the witching hour here of 5 o'clock. It's getting dark, and I got to get home before I turn into a pumpkin. So thank you, Sandy and Mitzi. We'll leave it here. It's a good break point. Is there any other business for tonight's meeting?
Well, just one thing I wanted to bring up is we did get an answer on the, you know, we got the resources that were out there in terms of what's available for emergency access to heat for homeless populations. But based on those answers, there appears to be significant gaps in the system. And I don't necessarily want to prescribe what the path forward is, but I don't want to drop the topic as long as there's realistic scenarios where we're pushing homeless people out in the cold and the freezing temperatures. So I'm curious as to what the appropriate path forward would be if this is something that we want to address.
Mr. Reimer?
Well, I think the first step is we can have some additional conversations with the other service providers. I think that's probably, to me, the most important. We know there's some gaps, see if there's some opportunities there. You know, what role do we have? And I'm not sure if that's a question of the council member or not. That's to be defined, to be determined. There's other service providers that maybe have some ideas. It could be a funding issue for some of them. And so I think just understand a little more than just
So your office will take that on?
Yeah, I think they have those initial conversations to take it on. We'll see where it goes, I guess, but I think they have those initial conversations.
Okay. Any other business for this evening? Mr. Campion.
Did we get that today, the report?
Okay. Yeah.
I have not seen it yet. And I will,
it was fantastic.
Okay. Well, that way we give you an opportunity as well. Mr.
Okay.
Reimer.
Well, I will look through it. I had another piece of business that I want to make sure that... Public Works has decided to... I have a few intersections that are causing some problems that are three-way intersections where a minor road meets a major road. So don't be surprised. I'm going to bring that forward, a petition, and we can discuss what our policy will be as a council, if we want to take these on one by one or if we want to have a policy. But what happens right now is some of them get addressed and some of them don't. And often the warrants don't actually represent the safety hazard. Sometimes people walk other ways and move around them. So I would just look for that. I'll probably be looking for another council member to sign on so that we can get it to a discussion point anyway. But food for thought there.
Okay. Mr. Hickey.
Are we talking stop signs or stop lights?
Stop sign. No, I'm not. Did I say stop light?
No.
Stop
sign. Curious.
Yeah,
no.
Hopefully not a stop light.
I've got a couple of those too. And I'm interested in the discussion, but I'm also interested in a lot of the things that the traffic engineers do. There's data behind why they're doing it. And the biggest one is the don't abuse the number of stop signs that you put up. And so I'm sensitive to the whole warrants thing and everything too. I would just ask that when we have that discussion, we make sure that we have the right resources to have the facts in front of us.
I totally agree. And so part of this is framing up a conversation that's going to, but I also want then to become the policy for the council, because
yes.
what gets to be disproportionate is when some council members deal with it one way and other council members deal with it another way. If we're going to have a policy, I'd like to see it enacted and equitable. And
2 stop signs per council member per year.
Mr. Reimer.
I mean, it's a policy.
Just circling back to the process for the comprehensive plan. So on January 3rd is when you continued it, and then to reopen the public hearing next week, just so we're on
so
the same page.
So we can still do
as
that.
The agenda comes out, you'll see that under public hearings.
And I will be bringing forward a council-initiated action when I get it all drawn up on vertical subdivisions. Really works more in the trying to get projects done beforehand. I've had some discussion with planning as well as with administration, and we'll be working on doing that in the near future.
Just remember, subdivisions of land trigger parkland dedication.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter if it's horizontal or vertical.
All right, so with that...
Should we be talking about what we're going to be looking to accomplish at the public hearing on the plan?
That'd be great.
Because if there's going to be, we're moving into further discussion at next meeting, I think that noticing a public hearing is, while I would love to continue to grind some of my fellow council members, I don't know that that is the most useful point of time for people to come down and sit through a full meeting thinking we're going to be debating a final document when it won't be ready. How does everyone else feel?
My intention, well, I think because the motion required it to come back at that date, so I don't know if we can address that, but I would put the explanation in there that this is going on, but I would say I would take the opportunity as well. I think the broader public deserves an update at that point, too, and staff could use that item to provide an update to where we are.
We can't amend this at this meeting. Is that true?
Talk, Mr. City
we
Attorney?
Can,
the
no.
action for that meeting, this part?
Yeah.
No.
So it's already been made because we filed it that way.
Yep.
All right.
Any advice to
perfect.
That works?
Yeah.
Perfect. With that, no other, Ms. Jensen?
So what we're
trying to be efficient.
I know. Oh, so what we would do is have the public hearing, but just inform the public that it's not the final document, and then request another continuation.
By consensus of the council, I would ask the RCA to reflect the high likelihood that this would be continued, given the draft nature of the document.
Okay.
Yes.
Perfect. I just wanted to be clear. Thank you.
No, that's everybody. Good. Knows. This is good.
With that all
said, to figure this out on Monday.
With that all said, let's adjourn this evening.
Okay.
All right. Excellent.
Thanks for bringing it up.
Yeah.